Discovering America, one Lebanon at a time. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Fadi Bukaram is from Lebanon, the country, but now he's visiting as many of America's Lebanons as he can.
I haven't been to Lebanon, Ohio, but when I go there, there's going to be a lot of questions. So.
Plus, a Korean immigrant remembers going American for Thanksgiving.
It was always the butterball turkey, the cranberry jelly that had the shape of the can, creamed onions that were eyeball-sized was something that they made every year, even though none of us ate it.
And a Syrian refugee finds joy at the Georgia Aquarium.
It was very exciting to see the whole ocean between your eyes, and you are inside it.
Those stories and more today on The World. Happy Thanksgiving. Glad you could be with us. I hope your day has been good so far. Thanksgiving is supposed to be the holiday that brings family and friends together, but togetherness feels like it's been in short supply this election year. President-elect Donald Trump was part of that disunity, and today he talked about that in a Thanksgiving video.
We've just finished a long and bruising political campaign. Emotions are raw and tensions just don't heal overnight. It doesn't go quickly, unfortunately. But we have before us the chance now to make history together, to bring real change to Washington, real safety to our cities, and real prosperity to our communities, including our inner cities.
A tall order for sure, given the political and cultural fault lines that the campaign laid bare. But earlier this week, I left the studio and made it as far as our parking lot, where I met a guy who gave me hope. I'm actually here at WGBH. It doesn't look like a radio studio. It's not a radio studio. It's a Winnebago. It's a mini camper called a Mini Warrior.
Yes, a Mini Winnie Warrior.
And I am here with Fadi Bukaram, who is from Beirut, Lebanon. And Fadi, tell us what you're doing.
I'm on a 5-month trip to visit, document, and photograph all the towns, cities, villages called Lebanon in the United States. And there's well over 40 of that.
How many Lebanons have you hit so far, and how many more do you have to go?
8 so far, so I have about 39 to 40. And when I say the number is not exact, because some of them are townships that are just named as plots of farming land, but they don't have people in them. So I'm discovering that as I go along.
How many states have a Lebanon? How many states are you going to be visiting?
39.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So take us to one of these Lebanons that you've been to, Lebanon, Nebraska. It was in the neighboring town of McCook that you had kind of an unnerving experience. Tell me about that.
Yes, it was my first and only unnerving experience in McCook. I was in a local bar there because that's where you meet people. It's a local bar, or you go to the churches, you know, where people are together. So I go to the bar, and there's a man, and he asks me, well, where are you from? I said, I'm from Lebanon. And so his face turns a little bit red. It's like, well, what are you doing in my town? It's like, I'm here to, and I explained the project. And he said, well, you came all the way from Israel for here to take photos. It's like, I'm from Lebanon, not Israel. But I was impressed that he knew the geography that kind of. And he got agitated. And I said, well, if you come to my town, you'd be more than welcome. That made him angrier. At that time, the barmaid, Alyssa, who was watching from afar, came in, kicked him out, and he was very nasty to her. And then I had my card on with her, so she gave it back to me. Your check's on the house. Everyone in the bar, and I mean everyone, came in and started apologizing for this man's behavior, saying, please don't take a negative idea about our town just based on how this drunk man is reacting. Yes, it was initially unsettling, but it turned out to be a really, really good one. And then I go park, you know, for the night, and I wake up, and on the passenger side window, I see a big post-it note, and it was from Alyssa saying, there's a lot of hatred in this world, but I hope you meet more good souls than bad ones along your way. Have a safe trip. And it was one of the best messages, you know, someone could ever receive.
What a fantastic little story. So that was actually election night. Fadi, what are you finding as kind of the connecting thread between the Lebanons that you've visited so far here in the United States?
All of these Lebanons that I've been to so far are tiny towns, like microscopic. That's how tiny. Lebanon, North Dakota has less than 10 people who live in it. Lebanon, South Dakota has 27, and Lebanon, Nebraska has about 40 people. you'll find a lot of senior citizens and older folks there. Because when talking to them, it turns out that it's all farming communities. And the one story I got was that in the 50s, when farming equipment got more efficient, they didn't need as much helping farming hands anymore. So the kids started leaving. The older folks stayed, and then when it became smaller, businesses started leaving. So they don't have grocery stores anymore. They don't have gas stations. They have to drive at least 20, 30 miles to go get what they need. Mm. After that, there were government cutbacks. They closed their schools. They closed their post office. So the folks are good people, but the condition that they live in, they're not exactly thrilled about what's going on to their way of life.
It's small town America. I mean, did you get the sense that these are people who voted for Donald Trump?
Undoubtedly. I don't say all of them, but a lot of them have voted for Trump. You could tell from the signs on the front lawns and all that.
Have you met any Lebanese in any of these Lebanons?
It's a funny story in Lebanon, Kansas. Lebanon, Kansas is the geographical center of the United States. So I go talk to a man and he says, well, my son is married to a Lebanese woman. But she's not here. It's like, okay. And then I keep walking around. A man at a gas station says, well, my nephew's married to a Lebanese. Then I see another one. It's like, well, my grandson is married to a Lebanese. It's like, must be a big Lebanese population. But it turns out the town is so small that they were all actually talking about one single woman. And they were all related. So, yeah, the grandmother, the mother, and the uncle, the dad and the uncle, they're all related to this one woman. But she lives in Manhattan, so I can talk to her. So,
really small town America. I gather you're also in search of the cedars of Lebanon on this trip. And this is kind of a mystery. The cedars, of course, are the national tree of your country.
Absolutely.
What's this part of the story about?
One time I was reading an article. It said that in 1955, the president at the time of Lebanon, Camille Chamoun, invited many mayors of towns called Lebanon to Beirut. So he invites them there. They spend 2 weeks on a, you know, sightseeing and all that. And after they're done, the first lady gives them each a sapling of a cedar of Lebanon, which is a, like the species, it's called Cedrus Libani, like in Latin. So they come here and they're supposed to plant them in their town. So my thing was, I want to go and see if they still have the tree, where is it, and the history associated with it and all that. So I've been to three towns that are supposed to have the cedar tree. Unfortunately, when I go there, the towns are just like, well, this is where your country gave us the tree. And in Lebanon, South Dakota, they had a big sign that says it's a gift from the Republic of Lebanon. And the puzzling part to me is that it wasn't a cedar of Lebanon. Lebanon, South Dakota, Lebanon, Nebraska, Lebanon, Oregon, neither of these had a cedar of Lebanon. It was actually a juniper tree. I didn't have the heart in me to tell them that this is not a cedar tree because they were kind of proud of it. So the story here is that Lebanon dictated that these trees had to stay in a nursery for 2 years to be, you know, to acclimate and all that. So that nursery is in Ohio. And then after the 2 years, Lebanon, Ohio, they claim that they gave cedars of Lebanon back to the towns. But none of these are. I haven't been to Lebanon, Ohio, but when I go there, there's going to be a lot of questions. So,
yeah, a lot of explaining to do. So what's your hypothesis right now about what happened? I mean, just based on what you know.
The trees couldn't survive in a climate that's not, you know, the mountainous side of Lebanon. So they kind of died, but they didn't want to tell them. So they just gave them the closest thing, which is the juniper tree in the U.S., in the eastern part of the U.S., it's called a red cedar. Mistakenly. So I was like, well, here's a cedar. So,
all right. So we end this interview on a mystery. So if you, we're going to crowdsource this one. So if you are a botanist, if you live in any of these Lebanons and know about these trees, if you know anything about Lebanese politics in the 1950s, please help figure this one out for us. And Fadi, how's the old Winnebago holding up so far?
It's been perfect, aside from 2 days ago when the temperature dropped to 29 and the cup of coffee was a block of ice. Full block of ice, like no dripping. So that's the only that's the only bad part of it. Other than that, no complaints. Beautiful. So.
Fadi Boukaram from Lebanon is hoping to document and photograph all 47 towns throughout the United States called Lebanon. We've been speaking with him in his RV here in the WGBH parking lot. Fadi, it's been great to meet you. Thanks for having us inside your mobile home.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed my time with that guy. We'll be checking in with Fadi as he continues his cross-country road trip. Thanksgiving is a day for cooking, sharing recipes, generally obsessing about food. But it's worth pausing to remember that many people in the U.S. struggle to get enough to eat or to find healthy food near where they live and work. That's true in the Rust Belt city of Erie, Pennsylvania. Much of it is classified as a food desert, a place where people don't have access to fresh, nutritious food. But Erie is also a place that has welcomed thousands of refugees in recent years. And in one stretch of town, it's the stores run by these refugees that are making a big difference. Erica Barris has our story.
Samantha Dungle pulls bags of vegetables out of the freezer at UK supermarket. In her cart are onions and eggplant, but what she's pulling out, I don't recognize, and she only knows by its Nepali name.
Dhania.
That's a leafy green that her Nepalese husband uses in his cooking.
You can't find stuff like this in Walmart or Kmart or wherever people shop.
Actually, you can't find stuff like this in much of the city. Most of Erie is a food desert. Before this store opened 2 years ago, there were a couple convenience stores and a few fast food spots around. All of them sold food that wasn't nutritious, says Alex Uorio. She's the public health educator for the Erie Department of Health. This place is different.
This store has tons of whole grain rice, whole grain meals, flours, things like that. Lots of dry beans and peas, which are high in protein. So all of those are considered healthy, and store owners like carrying items like that because they have a longer shelf life.
With UK Supermarket, this stretch here on Parade Street isn't a food desert anymore. It's one of about 20 grocery stores that have popped up in Erie in the last decade. Before, if people around here wanted fresh vegetables or things like cornmeal or nuts, they'd have to drive across town or to the suburbs. Then, 2 years ago, Pradipu Preti, a Nepalese refugee, opened this store.
I looked in the community and found that there really is a need of an Asian-based store in Erie, which we don't have too many.
He wasn't trying to solve the food desert problem. None of these store owners were. They just wanted refugees in Erie, who make up 10% of the city, to have access to specific foods. People would drive distances and buy up items like jackfruit and halal pizza, and then they'd resell those items to people in their community. Pradipu Preti saw that opening.
I wanted to do more, like a lot of people having to travel to Pittsburgh or Cleveland just to get their groceries didn't quite sound too good to me.
Upreti's store carries mostly South Asian foods. Across the street is an Iraqi-owned store. They have lots of spices. Around the corner, another Iraqi store specializes in fish and meats like lamb and goat. And there are well over a dozen more of these stores. Upreti gets customers from everywhere.
Right now, Indian and Nepalese are the biggest two ethnic groups, along with Africans, Arabic Americans, and some Vietnamese and Burmese.
But even so, the majority of customers are actually longtime residents of the area. They get fruits and vegetables and cigarettes and dish soap. Alex Iorio from the health department knows this spot because she runs Erie's Healthy Corner Store Initiative. It helps Pennsylvania cities that have food deserts. She visits the stores to ensure they have healthy foods on the narrow packed shelves. If they do, they get rewarded. $100 a year, new shopping carts, or vegetable display cases. She doesn't know where people got their groceries before these stores started popping up.
I'm not sure. There were always some corner stores, but we think that people are going to buy what they have access to and what they're used to.
Having these stores here isn't a full-on solution. As stocked as they may be with whole grain rice and vegetables, people like Swapna Sibaram still pick up other things. Her shopping cart is full.
I buy all the kinds of vegetables, rice, yogurt, dal.
And a few other things, like ingredients for some sweet desserts. For The World, Erica Barris, Erie, Pennsylvania.
You're with The World. In the kindergarten version of Thanksgiving, we learn that the first dinner was a harmonious gathering of pilgrims and Native Americans who showed them how to grow crops in the New World. If you take that narrative, the contrast with what we're seeing now with the Standing Rock Sioux Nation protests couldn't be more stark. Sub-zero temperatures, rubber bullets, injuries. This Thanksgiving week, there are thousands of people spending time at the protest camp, and Brian Yawsey drove to the camp to cook for them. He's the head chef at the Sioux Chef. That's Sioux, S-I-O-U-X, as in the tribe. The Sioux Chef is a Minneapolis-based catering and food education company. And Yawsey took a U-Haul to North Dakota full of donated food.
I will be taking over the main kitchen here. I connected with other cooks and chefs at these various kitchens here at the camp. And we teamed up and we planned to create a feast focused on indigenous food.
Part of the mission of your catering company, the Sioux Chef, is to educate people about indigenous foods. Explain what you mean by indigenous foods, first of all.
It's food from our own backyard, from our own rivers, forests, and a 1 mile radius in your region. Everything you can find, non-European ingredients, no gluten, no dairy, no processed sugar. So it's all fresh that is grown here in North America.
Is there enough of that kind of local indigenous food where you are right now?
Yes, we have local farms in Twin Cities who donated a bunch of indigenous ingredients, dried goods, some bison, venison, you know, bison heart.
Did you say bison heart?
Yes.
What does that taste like?
It's a bit of a mild flavor. Just depends on how you prepare it.
How do you turn that into kind of an indigenous meal? What ingredients would you add to that?
I plan to thin slice the bison heart and marinated in fresh water with juniper berries and fresh cedar. So I'm going to have it soak in the water for a couple hours, and I'm going to saute it on the griddle.
Tell me about the atmosphere in the camp today. What's it like?
It started snowing early this morning, and everyone's up as normal. You know, there's coffee made at the main fire. There's people singing. There's tribes from different regions who are praying. Right now, I'm calling from inside the main kitchen. I have my team here are prepping some hominy. I have one lady here working on the blue corn mush, which will be used for the soup.
Blue corn mush, that sounds good. I know you're a member of the Navajo Nation, Brian. How does it feel to be, you know, cooking on this Thanksgiving holiday, the same time that Native Americans and their supporters are in the standoff with the North Dakota government?
There's a historical trauma, negative history of Thanksgiving. You know, it's mixed emotions of it, of course. But as a chef, I'm staying positive, and I'm focused on how my ancestors gave their life on this day with their mentality of creating a meal and feeding those who are hungry and starving. So that's the mentality I have today with positive energy. What you put into food is what you give out, giving strength to those who need to be fed and keep strength to keep fighting.
We wish you lots of energy today, Brian. I know you're going to need it. Brian Yawsey, chef de cuisine at the Sous Chef, a Minneapolis-based catering and food education company, speaking with us from the Standing Rock Sioux Nation camp. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
Here's an ad that might sound familiar.
I wanted to know who I am and where I came from. I did my ancestry DNA, and I couldn't wait to get my pie chart. The most shocking result was that I'm 26% Native American. I had no idea.
You ever been tempted to try one of those genetic testing kits like Ancestry.com or 23andMe? I haven't done one. I know that my family's all from Europe, but I'm curious to know about before that. The CBC's Catherine Marlowe has been looking into what it means when these tests tell you things like the woman in the ad found out you are part Native American. Catherine Marlowe joins us from Calgary. So you get the kit, Catherine, swab your mouth, send it back, and you find out you're Native American. Now what?
Well, in a way, that's it. Basically, what you get is these percentages, like we heard in the ad. What they're doing, these companies, is testing your DNA for these things called genetic markers, and they each have their own databases that include DNA from around the world. So they find those matches and they say, oh, okay, according to this, you belong in this section of the map. Now, different companies have different databases, but they range from having about 25 to 30 ethnic regions, as they call them. Mm-hmm. Some of these regions are really specific. You mentioned that your family is from Europe, so you could find out that you're Irish or that you're Italian and Greek. But when it comes to North America, all you could find out is that you are Native American, which could mean from the northern tip of North America to the southern tip of South America. So, sorry, all of the Americas are encompassed in Native America. And I wanted to know what that meant to be told then that your DNA matched Northern Native American DNA. So I spoke with Kim Tallbear. She teaches in the Faculty of Native Studies at the University of Alberta. She grew up on a reservation in South Dakota. Here's what she thinks about these tests.
That's really interesting, but that doesn't mean you're Native American. It means you have an ancestor who is from one of the founding populations in the Americas, but you also have ancestors who are from all over the place. I mean, being a Native American isn't just about having an ancestor among those founding populations. So it's not just a matter of what you claim, but it's a matter of who claims you. And if no Indigenous community claims you, it's a little bit presumptuous to be running around saying, I am therefore Native American.
It sounds like this could all get really problematic, especially when it comes to identity.
It could. I mean, there's sort of the fun, interesting side of it. A lot of people like studying ancestry. It maybe means that you can go on a trip to Africa or to Ireland, and it might feel like it means a little bit more to you. But as you mentioned, there's sort of a dangerous side to this as well. And the Indigenous people I spoke with say it allows for a subtle kind of racism, one that romanticizes Indigenous culture without acknowledging the hardships that Native American communities have faced since European contact. Here's Kim Tallbear again.
There is this national sort of story that you have people with no lived experience in indigenous community. They can't even name any indigenous family or ancestors, but they have a family myth about a Cherokee great-grandmother, or they're descended from Pocahontas. That's a really common claim in Virginia. And so that's the context in which these tests are so popular.
Catherine, you actually went the extra mile and contacted the woman in that Ancestry.com ad we heard earlier, Kim Trujillo.
That's right. And Kim is she's a real person who had her test done. She says she was shocked to discover how much Native American DNA she had, not that it existed at all. But I asked her what she does with that information after that, especially after having spoken with Kim Tallbear and some other people and hearing about this, I guess, gap between your DNA and your lived experience. It turns out that Kim Trujillo was not surprised to hear this question from me. In fact, she lives in New Mexico. That's where she is from. And she works on a lot of movie sets. And she was speaking with an actress who is a Native American woman and said sort of, hey, guess what? I'm Native American too. Maybe you saw that ad. And the response was, yeah, okay, so what tribe are you from? Mm. And here's how Kim responded.
You know, the DNA doesn't say. So I've had to do my own genealogy and find that out. And then there's the other cynical people like, oh, you can get benefits or you can get casino revenues. And, you know, there's that. Like, no, I'm not doing it for that.
Kim Trujillo sort of put it into an interesting context. She took the information and then used it to go back and do more sort of family tree paper genealogical research. She also got a lot of information from these tests. These companies actually give you sort of access to these cousins, people who have similar genetic markers to you. And through that, she has met people from across the world, including indigenous people in North America, who she now has formed Facebook friendships with. Mm. And she says she sort of is paying more attention to the causes that they're dealing with. I asked her about if it's changed the way she looks at things like what's happening in Standing Rock. And she says it does make it sort of give a more personal connection to her. So she argues that she knows she can't just show up on a reserve and say, hey, you know, sign me up, but that it does help her sort of fill in some gaps and understand her history and the continent's history more.
Catherine Marlowe, a producer with the CBC program 180. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
You're listening to The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. Still to come on the show, a premature birth shatters the world for a Portuguese superstar.
As a mom, I was loving him so much. At the same time, I was so furious with God, like, why you are doing this to me? Me, why?
What singer Maritza is thankful for, that's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. In Clarkston, Georgia, outside of Atlanta, Malik Al-Armish is grateful to have a job in a coffee shop. Malik is 23 years old. He's originally from Syria, and he's especially thankful to be living in America now with his sister and their parents. Malik says he got arrested for protesting back home, that he was put in jail and tortured. He escaped to Jordan, and the family applied for asylum in the U.S. 18 months later, they got it. Malik says he didn't know anything about the state of Georgia when he found out that's where the family would be moving 3 months ago, so he Googled it.
The first thing, it was Georgia Aquarium. I saw it, and actually I wanted to be there, so I went there when I came. After 1 month, we went there. And it was very exciting to see the whole ocean between your eyes and you are inside it. So it's very exciting.
Even without seeing the aquarium, Malik and his family are lucky. If President-elect Donald Trump follows through on his campaign rhetoric, Syrians might not be eligible for refugee status anymore. The World's Global Nation editor Monica Campbell has been following the story. Trump has said Syrian refugees represent this great Trojan horse that would trigger terrorist attacks, Monica. What can he do when he becomes president?
He can do a lot. He can reduce or completely eliminate the number of refugees coming to the United States, including from particular countries like Syria. And this is something where he has unilateral power to do. He also can try and implement more vetting, but it's still very unclear what that type of vetting might look like.
And would this be executive action? Does he have to go through Congress on any of this?
He doesn't have to go through Congress. This is an executive action. He has executive power to do this. And this is something where we also have seen with the appointments that he's made so far, the people who are in his transition team, it suggests that he's at least very much leaning toward either suspending the refugee program when it comes to Syrians and perhaps people from other countries, or stopping it altogether. I mean, he said, you know, we're going to pause things. We don't know if this is something that can be paused indefinitely for a little while. That's still very unclear. But he definitely has the power to stop the amount of refugees coming into the United States from Syria.
There's a lot of vetting for refugees, full stop. But what about Syrians? Do they face more vetting generally than other refugees?
Absolutely. I talked to a couple of people who know very well how this system works. Already, refugees are among the most scrutinized and vetted people who come into the United States. Now, if you're from Syria, it gets even more intense. I mean, there's at least two dozen agencies and government authorities who are involved in the vetting of Syrians. They have multiple interviews than any other refugee right now trying to get into the United States. So there's definitely two sides to this, though. I talked to Jessica Vaughn. She is with the Center for Immigration Studies, and that is a group that supports tightening U.S. immigration and refugee flows. And she says that there really is no program strong enough to vet people coming from Syria because we can't be on the ground in Syria like we could in other countries, for example, Iraq, but we can't verify who these people are, where they're coming from, that this system can be corrupted, it can be penetrated, and that eclipses any humanitarian obligation that the United States has.
The risk of ISIS actually succeeding in getting people through our screening system far outweighs our compassion and hope to help Syrians fleeing danger.
And somebody on the other side of this, her name is Becca Heller. She's worked for years with refugees from war zones, places like Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, and she leads the International Refugees Assistance Project. She says that the vetting system is solid, that it's been in place for over three decades, and it was retooled after 9/11. It became quite a bit stronger, and that taking it to another level presents some real constitutional issues.
So to institute further vetting, I think, would look a little bit like we were just looking for an excuse to not let Muslims into the country, which, of course, would be unconstitutional to have a religious test for immigrating to the United States, and that we were just using vetting as a mechanism to try to achieve that.
Monica, you've met Syrian refugees. What's their overall state of mind right now?
Well, a lot of Syrians in the United States who have been resettled in the United States, they're making their lives there, are relieved to be in the United States. I mean, I'm thinking of one family who I've kept in touch with there in California. They left Syria just weeks before their home was destroyed by a bomb. They spent almost 2 years in Jordan before being resettled into California. But, you know, they have family still in Syria. So the worry is that there's going to be this shutdown, that the people that have been left behind are going to be, you know, continuing to face danger in Syria, and you won't have the family reunification that they hope for.
The World's Global Nation editor, Monica Campbell. Great to speak with you, Monica. Thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
Newcomers to this country all adjust to local traditions in their own way and time. Some hang on to rituals from the home country. Others jump more quickly to embrace the new. When Korean-American author Marie Myung-ok Lee was a little girl growing up in Minnesota, her immigrant parents were all about America's Thanksgiving and everything it had to offer.
My dad thought everything in America was so amazing. So you may or may not remember they had these electric turkey slicers. It was so goofy, and it didn't work, and it would splatter turkey all over the place. But that would, right. That to me, in retrospect, is just, you know, my father's complete faith that everything in America is going to be wonderful. The future is here. He and my mother just decided we're going to just put all our chips here in America. We've declared a love, and we're going for it.
Marie Myung-ok Lee's parents were both from what is now North Korea. They'd fled to the South just before Korea split in two. Her mom and dad managed to get a visa to the States because her father, who was a doctor, had worked as a translator for U.S. troops stationed in Korea. Finding work in the U.S. wasn't easy, but Myung-ok Lee's father finally landed a job as the only anesthesiologist in the remote Minnesota mining town of Hibbing. In her childhood home there, Myung-ok Lee says her parents did their best to ensure that every Thanksgiving was identical to the previous one.
It was always the butterball turkey, the cranberry jelly that had the shape of the can, creamed onions that were eyeball-sized was something that they made every year, even though none of us ate it. My sister and I made little pilgrims out of old corks, and we went to town.
Why do you think your parents were so enthusiastic about Thanksgiving? Was it because maybe of what they had left behind in Korea?
For them, what was great about Thanksgiving, even more so than Christmas, because Christmas is somewhat of a religious holiday and people kind of celebrate it differently. With Thanksgiving, you have the Better Homes and Gardens cookbook. This is how you make the turkey. You have to have stuffing.
There's a guide
to it. You do this. Exactly. It really is something that, as immigrants, that they could follow and feel very much that this is how you do it.
I mean, it's important, though, to create that sense of home. And I imagine especially so for your parents. I know your mother was only 14 when she fled south.
Yes. She was helping an aunt flee. She had her toddler nephew on her back. And not only did she have to flee in the middle of the night, this is when the border was becoming heavily militarized, but the next day her family was supposed to follow, but that's when the border became completely closed. So one of the things that was a sort of abiding regret for her is that she never even really properly said goodbye to her own mother. And so I think for them to make this holiday for us was probably a way for them to look forward and not back. Mm.
So your father was a doctor, a very skilled doctor. He and your mother came to the U.S. in the early 50s and ended up in Hibbing, Minnesota, a small mining town. But your father had some visa issues.
Yes.
What was going on?
The 1924 Immigration Naturalization Act basically deemed all immigrants from East Asia to be unwelcome. And so in the quota system generally was zero for people from Korea. As family lore goes, the day I was born, my parents received the deportation papers. And so my parents didn't know what to do. They immediately got scammed by an immigration lawyer to whom they gave a ton of money. And it wasn't until the hospital was also realizing, because where we lived was so remote and so difficult to attract doctors, that they really were going to have to do something.
Yeah, so what'd they do?
They brought out a petition to the town. And since my father's an anesthesiologist, pretty much every family had been treated by him, whether for birth, an accident, any kind of operation. And people came and actually, they literally signed this petition. A lot of people wrote extra letters talking about how he would spend every night, you know, at people's bedsides, you know, talking to them about the operation. Sometimes people would be scared. They'd want to talk for an hour. And so our congressional representative took it to Congress. It was rejected by the State Department because they felt that someone like my father, should he get what would be the equivalent of a green card, the first thing he's going to do is leave Hibbing and, you know, strike out somewhere where he doesn't have to be the only doctor and he's not underpaid. And
of course, that wasn't your father's intent, I suppose.
Correct. But that's pretty much what they felt any rational person probably would do in that situation. So the petition was rejected, but our representative, James Oberstar, actually told the State Department that he knew my father and knew he was a really honorable person, that he would not do that. And he gave his word that my father wouldn't do something like that. And so there's a House resolution that was passed, an actual law passed, keeping my parents in the U.S. because my father was somehow essential to civil defense. Mm. And that's why I'm here talking to you right now.
That is wild. I mean, it's like the town banded together just like in It's a Wonderful Life or something.
Exactly. I always wondered why my father used to make us watch this movie that was so sappy.
So your parents were able to stay in Hibbing. Your father worked there at the hospital for 40 years, and they
yes.
celebrated the holidays like Thanksgiving in very American fashion. You've called it a sort of recommitment ceremony to America. Can you just explain that?
I will say when I was in elementary school,
I actually would get physically beat up a lot. And one day I remember coming home and going, you know, these kids beat me up. They're calling me a chink, you know, and crying. And my father saying very solemnly to me, you tell those kids you're an American.
So fast forward to the present. What do you make of that Thanksgiving gift your parents gave you, the optimism, the feeling of safety, the feeling that next Thanksgiving would be just like the last one? Is Thanksgiving this year going to be the same as last year?
Since November 8th, I'm feeling like it's going to be very different. I feel as an adult that I'm very grateful that my parents have given us that kind of stability, that we could be bored with Thanksgiving, given sort of the precariousness with which we grew up, but that we did not realize at the time. Every so often, I think, wow, I could be growing up in North Korea if not for my parents. But now I just feel this Thanksgiving could be very much like how the day I was born was a happy day for my parents, and it just was a pretty terrible day as well. I feel very keenly that this kind of uncertainty that's hanging over people, particularly people who are undocumented immigrants, I feel very much a kinship because there is this disconnect where sometimes people will even say, it's so sad just because of a technicality that you were almost deported. But then I have to explain, no, that is how people become undocumented. In fact, the other day I had to explain to someone that I was referring to my parents as undocumented immigrants, and they said, oh, yeah, that's different than the illegals. And I said, no, 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 that's just a different way that I am describing them.
Right. Don't push those concerns aside, but what are you going to tell yourself this year to keep things positive?
I'm going to tell myself that we always find a way, because often when I think of the idea that my parents both escaped from North Korea – and they both managed to immigrate at a time when there was no immigration from Korea. And against all odds, they managed to stay here. Problems that I have should be something that I can power through thanks to the generation that's come before me.
Marie Myung-ok Lee teaches writing at Columbia University. I hope you have a Thanksgiving this year just like the other ones. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
So several places around the U.S. got some snow on this holiday, but it's the snow in Tokyo I want to talk about for a second. Today, for the first time in 54 years, Tokyo got snow in November. They usually get one or two snowfalls a year in the Japanese capital, usually January, February. It doesn't usually accumulate, but today they got about an inch. So just because, here's a little ditty about the weather. From the French band Nouvelle Vague and their just released album, this is La pluie et le beau temps, the rain and nice weather.
Toute la vie est faite de jours et de nuits. Le temps gris laisse la place à l'éclaircie. C'est ainsi et il faut apprécier autant la pluie. Et le beau temps. Cette nuit, je vais rejoindre mon amant. Près de lui, je vais compter plus que le temps. Je m'ennuie, alors je regarde en passant la pluie. C'est ainsi, après le beau temps, la pluie.
La pluie et le beau temps, lovely track off the new album by Nouvelle Vague. This is the world. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. The wonderful Portuguese fado singer Maritza is back with her first studio album in 5 years. It's called Mundo, or World.
Na minha voz noturna nasce rio que não se chama Tejo nem Mondego que não leva barqueiro nem navio. corre por entre o arvoredo.
Maritza had turned her back on the recording studio when she became a mom. Like many popular singers who have babies, she had to figure out how to juggle motherhood and stardom, parenting and touring. Naming her new recording Mundo is actually one way to help connect the two.
Mundo is an invitation to people to get inside of my world, my musical world, my personal world, because I can't separate it both. You know, I'm just one person, so everything is connected.
What has been the biggest change for you since you've become a mother in terms of music?
Well, I realize that exists just one love, but several types of loving. The love that you have for your children, the love that you have for your parents, the love that you have for your husband, for your friends. Everything is love, but you feel in different ways. And that I can explore when I sing. I'm singing more the feelings because fado is a music which settles down in the feelings of life and the feelings of human beings. So when I became more mature and I start understanding better the feeling of love, the way of singing changed completely.
Mm. Do you think you are a better singer now?
Yes, I am. I think I'm a better singer now, even a better person.
It's funny because a lot of people say, you know, well, children completely changed my life. I had to focus on them. I had to give up some other things. It sounds like it's the opposite for you.
You know, I realized I had a baby, what you call a big premature. My baby was born with almost 26 weeks.
Wow.
He lived 6 months in an incubator. And today is a completely healthy baby, doesn't have problems, nothing.
Almost hard to imagine that even happened.
Yeah, and you look to a person, such a small person, that I'm, as a mom, I was loving him so much. I was wanting him so much. At the same time, I was thinking, like, this is fair. I was so furious with God, like, why you are doing this? To me, why? So all of that make me grow. And I realized that music, it's really more love. I know we have to do good music, but it's love, it's give and receive. So more and more my concerts are more in smaller places, more intimate. I want to touch people. Mm. I want to look in their eyes. I want to try to understand if they are understanding my message. The message is, let's be all together, connected.
What a powerful kind of conclusion from that experience. I've always wanted to ask you this. I find your performances, your live performances, really extraordinary. I mean, you express yourself in whispers and in kind of vocal explosion. And your recordings do show us your talent, but they are kind of unfair because they don't kind of capture the full drama of what you do in a live performance. Do you feel that difference as well?
Yeah, I feel it. I feel it. It's really tough, you know, doing a record and trying to put everything that you can really feel when you are doing a live concert.
Mm. And you wouldn't stop making records, but how do you reconcile those two different personas?
You know, I try all the time when I'm on studio, just being me with me and putting all my emotions out. But when I'm on stage, I'm there and I have all that eyes looking at me like, show us. And in the beginning, the first three or four songs, I feel a little bit shy. And I'm trying always to understand, like, wow, what type of energy I have here today, what they want, what
right,
they
and
are.
That relationship between the audience doesn't happen on an album
don't
either.
Have an album, but I have a relationship with myself when I'm doing an album.
Há caminho inseguro, uma espécie de muro, degrau sobre os dois. Uma energia constante, rodopio da manta à espera de ser dois. Uma carta que se atrasa, cigarro, brasa, a cinza no chão. Desvendar de segredo e a mão quase a medo a pegar-te na mão. Como é que eu
The kind of folklore about fado is that centuries ago women would sing it as their husbands, their men would go out to sea and be gone for years, or maybe they'd never see them again.
Hmm.
So it's this mournful, it's got that saudade that you say in Portuguese, that mournful quality. Do you think fado was ever meant to be recorded?
I'm the ambassador of for the dossier that we introduced to UNESCO to make Fado Mundial Heritage. And we did it. UNESCO...
It's now a cultural heritage.
Cultural heritage. And the most unbelievable thing that we found from an English gentleman who had a storage he bought many years ago from a radio was completely going down. He bought all the things that the radio had. And one of the things that the radio had was records from the most old fado singers who was at the end of the 19th century.
Wow, that's incredible.
So it was an emotion when we start hearing people from the end of the 19th century singing fado, you know. So I think fado was always, how do you say, when you have something hide, the most high diamond from Portugal. Now it's more open because you have more platforms where you can show, you know, musicians, singers, everything. But for many, many years was like the most beautiful diamond, pure in Portugal.
A diamond in the rough. Oh, thanks to technology. It's very shiny.
Yeah,
you can see
it's
it
good.
So we're going to go out, Maritza, with a song from your album called Anda o Sol na Minha Rua. How's my pronunciation on that?
Fantastic.
Don't just blow
smoke. It's true. Anda o Sol na Minha Rua.
What does it mean?
The sun walks on my street.
Anda o sol na minha rua, cada vez até mais tarde.
Maritza, the new CD is titled Mundo. Thanks for the new music and great to see you again.
Thank you so much.
And that'll do it for us on this fourth Thursday of November from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Enjoy the rest of your holiday.
PRI, Public Radio International.